cold days are tough. In a lot of sports, you're worrying about overheating athletes. In our sport, we're trying to heat up athletes and to avoid being frozen, literally.
Welcome to the First Beat Sports Podcast, where we talk with coaches and sports scientists to explore the latest in how performance monitoring is making a difference in the NCAA and pro sports alike. We're going to connect you with practical advice from the best in the business to help you take your athletes to the next level. On the line today is Daryl Gray. Daryl is the High Performance Director at Burke Mountain Academy, the leading ski racing academy in the United States. Among the topics Daryl will discuss are the unique travel and environmental demands of alpine skiing, his 8 key domains of high performance, and techniques to enhance recovery in athletes. So let's get started. Here's your host, head of First Beat Sports USA, Benjamin Jensen.
Daryl, thank you for being here. We appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Glad to be with you.
And if you could just give us a bit of background on your career to date, how you ended up at Burke Mountain and the different roles you've had there.
Sure. I started coaching in the mid-80s down in North Carolina and Virginia. And then I migrated north 1997 to Burke, northern Vermont. I tell people, be careful what your passions are. You never know where you'll end up. So I would have never guessed 25 years ago I'd be in Vermont doing what I'm doing. This will be my 23rd year here. I've worked with U16 age athletes to U21 age athletes, both men and women, predominantly working with the men. I spent 10 years as the men's head coach, 15 years as director of strength conditioning. So I worked with the off snow with the men and the women. And the last 4 years, I've been in a new position, new role as high performance director.
Okay. And with that new role, the high performance director, what exactly does that entail?
When people ask, I say I coach athletes still on snow and off snow, although my on snow is mostly with return from injury, return to skiing athletes, although I still travel occasionally to races and competitions. Then off snow, I'm working with the athletes in their dry land training. Then I also say I coach coaches, share my experiences in working with the coaches here.
Okay. And sorry, I got asked the question, which one's easier to coach, coaching the coaches or coaching the athletes?
Well, I'd say they both have their challenges. I'm going to be politically correct here.
That's a very good, safe answer. I love that. Okay, so you're slightly different from some of our previous guests in the sense that you've been at the same program for over 20 years now. What are the biggest changes you've seen during that time, whether it's the type of athletes coming in, coaching philosophies, or even development of technology?
Before I jump into that side of things, I want to just give a brief background on the actual sport. Some of the listeners may not know alpine skiing, but we train in 5 different disciplines, from slalom to downhill. Speeds in slalom, 25 to 30 miles an hour. Forces, 2 to 4 Gs in turns that last three quarters of a second. To downhill, where speeds are 75 plus miles an hour. Turn radius, 3 to 4 seconds. 3 to 4 Gs in all kind of weather, below zero temperatures, Fahrenheit, snow, wind, rain, sunshine, all different surfaces. So the sport in which we work in, first of all, is constantly varying and changing. The training environment changes day to day. The course sets, the events that are trained vary from day to day. And so with that, over the last 20 years, getting to your question, the changes we've had have been quite significant. First of all, we ski in the prep period, which is from May through November. We ski quite a bit more now than we used to. We used to ski 5 to 10 days 20 years ago during the prep period, and now we ski 40 plus days during our prep period. So that's a pretty significant change. So we have way more time on snow. We compete internationally within the U.S. and Canada, but then also in Europe and sometimes in South America or the Southern Hemisphere during our summers. So the sport demand has changed, our time on snow. So we're more specific to our training. The athlete-wise, we still get great athletes. And we have, when I do our physical testing, I look at our metrics and go, wow, we still have good movers, explosive athletes, strong, fit. But the thing that is probably the most lacking is most of them have come through some sort of structured coaching environment. Many of them, I should say, and most lack the spontaneity that comes from play, or, you know, the creativity that shows up when they're out just goofing off. And so that shows up in how they approach tactically skiing, problem solving, in terms of how they move. So that's probably the biggest change.
That's actually really interesting to find out that if they come from programs where there seems to be like a lot of discipline and a lot of structure, actually, it's not always a good thing.
not when they're really young, I think. I mean, I'm going to speak out of both sides of my mouth here, but there's some technical aspects in skiing that are more easily taught when you're young, just like some other sports. However, expressing themselves, it needs to be helps if it's developed internally, intrinsically, and less from an outside source directing movements. So the patterns are a little bit more true to who they are as a mover. And that's where I see the difference, really.
That's actually a really interesting viewpoint. Yeah, so I wanted to actually go back a little bit to when you were talking about the different types of conditions, temperatures, this and that. Can you give me an example of just, let's say, the nastiest conditions that you guys have had to compete in? I mean, just what was the worst you've dealt with?
Well, there's extremes in cold. I spent a winter with our competitions in Quebec and Ontario, and it seemed like every race was minus 20. So the high might be minus 10 Fahrenheit for the day. So cold days are tough. In a lot of sports, you're worrying about overheating athletes. In our sport, we're trying to heat up athletes and to avoid being frozen, literally. And then you have snowstorms, I mean, rain, wind. And for your athletes, you may have a situation where the three competitors in front of you have a tailwind, and then your athlete goes and has a headwind or a snow squall or a fog. So it's an outdoor sport. It's an ever-changing environment. You know, you may have your bad days, but you also have your good days.
Elements definitely make a huge factor there.
Yes, absolutely.
Something else that also differentiates you a little bit from our previous guests is you're working with high school athletes, if we're talking about 14 to 18 years of age, where the others are mostly collegiate professional, where probably their youngest would be 18. How do you go about creating a program that works for young adults who are still maturing?
First of all, we're in a foundation building. So even though my title is high performance director and we have a high performance initiative, it's really fundamentals that we're trying to do well. And so whether an athlete comes in who's 18 years old but has a training age of 1 year, they may be in the same group as a 14-year-old who has a training age of 1 year. So it's really looking at where they're coming in, what skills and abilities they have when they come in, and going from there. And likewise, we've often had athletes that come in at 14, 15, 16 years old who have a really strong training base, whether that's formal or informal, and you can do quite a bit with them. So we have to take them where they are.
Working with a sport like skiing, how is the training going to differ from, say, a traditional high school program of basketball or football?
Well, for one thing, our season is relatively long. When I think about our local high schools that may have a 3-month season, our season, competitive season, runs from November for some athletes, our older athletes, all the way through the middle of April. So it's a fairly long season. If you're a three-sport athlete, out of sport training, whether that's in the weight room or whatever, most likely you still have access to it because you're at least at home. We have athletes who will travel 45 or 50 competitions during a year. And so that's minimal travel days plus the travel days. So they're away from school anywhere from 60 to 70 days during the year, which means they're also away from their training resources we have here. So you have to kind of make do as you go. So the travel nature is different for most high school sports. The fact that we also have 5 camps during the prep period to make those 40 days plus on snow. So we're almost always traveling somewhere. So we don't have necessarily the long summer block for conditioning because we're still skiing or for our physical training. So we have to be creative in how we do both on snow training work and our off snow work. So it's a little bit different that way. And then the sport itself, we may have the athletes slip the course 3 or 4 times just to get the surface right for them training versus, you know, a high school basketball coach turns the lights on and starts playing in practice. So it's a little bit different in terms of the athletes having to be involved in preparing the surface for training as well as the training itself.
I bet they actually appreciate that a lot more than, like you said, you know, basketball players, if they had to clean the floor before they played as compared to these guys that got to groom the ski slopes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what are some key characteristics or abilities that you look for or try to develop in your athletes? I mean, the obvious answer with almost all other sports is strength and speed. What are the couple specifics that you're really looking to develop?
So we're all-arounders. Alpine skiers are, you know, I would call them the 80%ers. We're 80% to across the board on any kind of metric you might use. So aerobically, an example would be we run a 1.75-mile run, or if you use a 20-meter shuttle, our best athletes who come out of here and make national teams or ski for NCAA, classically run a 10-minute 1.75 or into the level 14s in the 20 meter shuttle. And they have good power. They're going to be mid 30s in their vertical jump. They're going to broad jump 9+ feet. They're going to clean 1.3 to 1.5 times their body weight. They'll squat 2 to 2.5 times their body weight. So they're strong. They have good agility, balance, and coordination. The sport of skiing requires this dynamic balance. Power endurance, our events last anywhere from 45 to 90 seconds, and they have to be pretty mobile. So we really are looking to develop well-rounded athletes.
Okay, yeah. Sounds like it's the full circle right there. As a boarding academy, how do you emphasize the balance between training and academics with these young athletes? Because obviously both are pretty big stressors on those kids.
Yes, they are. And I calculated a couple of years ago the load for our students and their obligated hours of either in the classroom, doing homework, tuning skis, training. We also maintain our dining hall facilities ourselves, our dorm facilities by the students as well. It's 64 and a half hours of obligated time during the comp period per week. And so then you're looking to maximize any time in the training session that you can give them off, or reduce load, or on the weekends, if we don't have training going on, or anytime we're looking for an ability to decompress a little, we're trying to take advantage of that. But it's a busy schedule in the comp period for sure.
Wow, so 64 hours. I didn't realize. I bet that's actually a good thing, though, that these guys would probably take a lot more pride in where they eat, where they sleep, if they're the ones that actually have to maintain it.
You would think that would be the case, but we're still working with teenagers, and I had three of them my own. So I know that cleanliness is not necessarily on the top of the priority list for some of them, but we try.
All right. We're going to hit the quick fire round. So I'm going to shoot questions at you and hopefully I get answers.
Okay.
All right. So your sporting hero growing up?
The Minnesota Vikings, Purple People Eaters. Of course, I'm from North Carolina, so I'd have to say Michael Jordan as well.
All right. Guilty music pleasure.
I listen to YouTube, live music, anything live, I like to hear.
And proudest moment in coaching?
Yeah, when athletes, it finally clicks for them, for their success, for all the work that they put into when it happens. Yeah.
Very cool. Favorite TV show?
Blue Bloods.
And biggest mentor in your career to date?
That was a tough question. And I think Burke Mountain Academy. I've had so many Olympic athletes who returned as coaches that I've learned a load from. We've had European, Austrian coaches come here and coach. So I'd say the place itself, I know, is my ongoing mentor because of the people that come here and work here. You're just exposed to some very talented people who've done quite well in their lives. It's hard not to learn from them.
Nice. If you could have been a pro in any sport, which sport would it be?
In January, it's surfing. In July, it might be skiing.
Yeah, I can feel that. And yeah, before we hit the first beat side of things, I actually wanted to touch on. So in the 50 years that Burke has existed, and you kind of answered this a little bit, but you produced 118 U.S. ski team members, 36 Olympians. What would you say is the driving force behind this success?
Well, a couple of things. One, the first might be the environment in which we're in. We're in the middle of nowhere, Northeast Kingdom of Northern Vermont. So you have to make an effort to come here. The second thing is, like the environment, the people that come here are pretty self-sufficient, independently motivated, intrinsically motivated, and really want to be successful in the sport of alpine skiing and in life for that matter. And so you combine those two things, relatively remote setting, people who are hardworking, want to do something. And that's the number one recipe in my mind is people in place. Put those two things together and you have a pretty powerful combination.
No, that makes sense that, I mean, with that kind of isolated environment, you don't have a whole lot of distractions, I would think.
We used to not. You know, now the technology is everywhere. It's a little bit different. That's something as a school we're having to work through ourselves. And in the last 20 years, it's been a significant change from having no phones in the dorms to everyone having Wi-Fi based off of their phone and can connect anywhere. So.
Good point. Good point. Okay. Yeah. Let's hit the first beat side a little bit. It's always interesting to hear the motivations behind a program that starts to use first beat. So after working with you over the past 5 years, if we go all the way back to the beginning, what were your reasons for introducing the system at Burke Mountain?
Well, initially, I really was looking for a way to determine load, the physical load, and manage that load. In some sports, you can manage load by volume or tonnage. And for skiing, understanding what those forces characteristics are and the load on an athlete, it's fairly complicated. And so I was looking for a way to really understand what was going on with our load. And then after doing that, for really pursuing that, my mind shifts a little bit to, toward recovery side of things, mainly as a way to inform athletes on what's going on with them, to help educate them about their own bodies and how their bodies are working. And I found it to be incredibly valuable that way.
So feedback was really important for you at that point.
Yes, the feedback both from the athletes, but primarily from First Beat, even in its most simplistic measures. When you have a training session and it gives you a graph at the end of your session, an athlete looks at it, and then you have questions and conversations that occur from what happened in that training session. So initially it was, again, very simple, but if you don't do simple well, it's hard to do the complex well.
Yep, definitely. So on that same topic, how is it mainly used, daily, weekly basis, and what metrics or features are you really focused on?
So we use First Beat, I think, pretty holistically, from especially in the off season when we're here using the new live system, which works great for us, is to actually in session monitor what's going on in their training, whether that's a mountain leg routine. We just hike up the mountain, you have an iPad with you, it's pretty easy. To a lift or a training session on a soccer field. So we can monitor in the session, and that's mainly off snow. We used it quite a bit in our camps early on in the year where we were just monitoring the day-to-day training. An example of that was we had a camp in Quebec where the altitude was maybe 1,500 feet or less. And then at the same time, we had a camp going on in Colorado where they're training, they're living at 9,000 feet and training at 11,500 feet. So when you're looking at the training effects from each day or the TRIMP scores from the day, you're looking at one group in Colorado whose training effect or TRIMP scores, their load is considerably higher, recognizing they're doing similar training. So just in that side alone, in accounting for altitude, it's been really important for us there. In addition to traveling, we started using the bodyguard several years ago to monitor travel. We have 12-hour flights to South America, or even though the time change, depending on the time of year, is we're not changing time zones, but the travel day is basically 24 hours. And so we're able to see the effect of their travel through the bodyguards. And the same this year, we were flying to Lithuania for training camps over there and then on into Austria. And so we look at a 5 or 6 hour time change and what effect it has on them. So the bodyguard's been really useful that way as well.
If we look at overnight recovery, kind of how does First Beat fit into that bit? When we talked about the bodyguard, but can you go into a little bit more kind of how you use that data?
Finishing up on the travel side, we'll have, if you look at the lack of recovery they get while being immobile, is kind of ridiculous. And for us, it really changed a little bit of how we manage our first day or two on snow. And then when we go to altitude, it's the same thing. We know that day 3 and 4, mostly our most difficult days in altitude, and the data just supports that. And so our decisions are more informed. And then in terms of the overnight recovery, we started using the lifestyle assessments a couple of years ago, which I really liked because it provided an athlete to basically journal 24 hours in their day for 3 days and look at the report. And then we can look at stress reactions and the recoveries that are coming in, and what they thought was a recovery may and may not be recovery for them. We look at, we see good sleepers from poor sleepers. Then we have conversations about, okay, what's your room like? What's the temperature? Are you on your laptop right before you go to bed? And so the lifestyle assessment has been key for us in terms of just having conversations. Now, it's not with every athlete. I'll do 10 lifestyle assessments with 10 athletes and have 3 deep conversations and a couple that are, okay, this is cool, and that kind of thing. But we're trying to, again, help the athletes figure out how they function so that they can perform better.
I was going to say, I bet you've got a lot of different types of interest levels from the kids of that age group, especially.
Yes, you have. I mean, you have the ones who are all in, who are very interested in what the data is showing and what they can change to improve performance. I mean, a great example is we do a velocity VO2 max intervals in the spring. And so the interval is set and we build the number of intervals over the course of the spring. And the conversation inevitably comes out that, okay, in the third week, how come I'm not in the red as much as I was in the first week? Or I did 8 more intervals than the first week and I'm not working as hard. And the answer to that is you're getting fitter. And it's very evident for them. And so again, it's good for them to see the adaptation, the physical adaptation to the work they're doing.
Yeah, I love those questions that come up, you know, is the red good or bad? And it's like, okay, sit down. We've got some things to talk about here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and that's our 20-meter shuttle testing. We would say that our fittest athletes spend the least amount of time in the red zone, right? And the ones who are less fit spend a lot of time up there. And so as you can argue, they're working harder. Now, you want to develop fitness as a result of that. But it's interesting when you start looking at the data.
Yeah, for sure. And so while we're here on this, I kind of want to touch on when you get the data, you look at sleep and everything, stress recovery, what methods or procedures do you implement with your athletes as far as even, you know, techniques or nutrition stuff that you do?
Well, a couple of things. We try to set the environment in which they're in to be conducive to having recovery. I mean, this came to, we had our dorm check-in for years was 10 o'clock at night, and we were training at 6:30 in the morning. And so if they showed up at 10 and got to bed by 10:30, they were definitely not going to get 8 hours of sleep. So the idea was, well, we have to institutionally set ourselves up for success. And so we just moved the dorm check-in to 9:30, which allows them to, by the time they get in and do what they need to do, to be in bed and at least get 8 hours of sleep. Now we have kids who are already asleep at 9:30, and we have those who would be up till midnight or 1 a.m. if they could. So first of all, it's for us to set up a environment that was conducive to recovery. When we travel, we try to get daytime flights and not red eyes. Red eyes can be notorious for getting people off their system or off their game, and it's difficult for them recovery, even though they're trying to sleep on a plane. So in certain ways, we start looking at it that way. And then other things is when we finish our training, you know, a concept is that we try to leave them after training how we want them the next day. So whether that is our warm down after training, stretch, foam rolling, whatever it may be, to also get parasympathetic response out of them, to just decompress. Even if it's only 15 minutes or 10 minutes for that matter, during the day, again, as we can within the 64 and a half hours of obligated time, is to find windows of opportunity for them to decompress. We're just coming off of a break. Tomorrow, the athletes return. It'll be amazing difference when I see them tomorrow and Sunday versus what I saw when we left them on Monday. It'll be very evident how time off matters.
Oh, cool. I bet you kind of look forward and dread seeing that data at the same time.
It's informative, and that's the biggest thing for First Beat. It doesn't replace coaching. It's a way to help inform decisions that we're making. In the training session, I may be doing an interval session. I'm using the live system. I'm looking at an athlete, their recovery between reps, and I'm giving them more time, or I'm able to send another one out on their next interval. It works in the moment, and hopefully it works to inform decision-making that we do in our planning. So it's multifaceted in how it can impact our coaching.
Yeah. So you just mentioned decision-making. So I actually want to touch on, you have like a specific example where you've had data really impact and change or influence training or planning of decisions.
Yes. And I'll go back to the example from one group in Quebec and one group in Colorado. The group in Quebec could just keep hammering the training. They were recovering. Altitude wasn't an issue. The volume was appropriate. And in Colorado, it was a little bit of a pullback. Like, okay, we've had four hard days. We need to take a day or maybe even two off to recover. And that recovery could still be going to our local rec center and playing games or going for a swim or in a pool or something like that, but it's still active. So that would be an example of how we would use it or have used it this past November. We look at the data. The recoveries aren't looking like we want them. The load looks very high, so we need to make modification. So that was in a training camp.
Nice. So actually during this time, were you with them at Colorado or were you in Quebec or were you actually at Burke monitoring both from there?
So I was actually in Quebec and working with the training there and was looking remotely. Obviously, the cool thing about the live system is cloud-based, is I was able to look at what was going on with the ladies in Colorado. And then it's an email conversation with coaches out there, and they're looking at the same thing there. And sometimes the data is absolutely right, and you need to respond to it. And so there's still coaches' intuition. You see with your eyeballs what's going on. You hear from the athletes their perspective, and you look at First Beat data or any kind of data that way to help just inform your decision.
No, that's great, actually, that you mentioned the coach's eye still. That's something that I really promote to any coaches who are kind of nervous about it or this and that. I say, you know, this is going to just help what you have done for the last 10, 20 years is you still got to have that coach's eye there. And hopefully this data will back it up. And in some cases, it may not. You may have to make some interventions.
Correct. Absolutely.
So on the practical side, have you secured buy-in from these young athletes as far as, you know, the application of the First Beat technology?
I'd say in some cases it's a strong yes. In other cases, it's still they're agnostic to it. They don't know whether they really believe in it or not. And that's okay, honestly, because often our feelings can mislead us on what we think. We think we know how our body's functioning and they mislead us, that we feel tired and incapable of doing a specific training. And then we're actually able to do it well. That would be a learning moment. So whether that's also First Beat helping you out with that or whether you're doing that on your own, we want the athletes to become their own best coaches and understanding what their body's capable of and doing. But we have had some good successes with athlete buy-in and coach buy-in. But every year we get a new group of kids. You know, 25 to 30% of our school turns over every year. But any coach who looks at it and looks at their athletes can see the benefit. It's really a matter of the timing of the use of and how much time it takes for them to make use of the technology.
Okay. And kind of staying on this subject with technology, with your industry, with the alpine ski industry, where do you see its role now and kind of in the future?
Well, right now we're getting, you know, I think very good internal load data from First Beat. So this is where athlete buy-in comes in. You may have a very hard training session outside on snow. The data from First Beat may indicate that it's moderate because there's external loads that we're not able to calculate. And yet, the way I look at it, you know, from a skiing perspective, if you're strong and fit and are highly skilled, the information you're going to get from First Beat, your training effect's going to be higher because you can push harder on the ski because you're stronger. You can take more runs. You can operate with less recovery time. The less skilled and less fit, the data really just shows how much work you need to do off snow to continue to grow and maintain. You're not going to ski your way into shape. You actually have to train in the gym and on the roads to get prepared for skiing or to keep improving through the winter. And that's probably our biggest takeaway from skiing and from using First Beat. The other things we're looking at is being able to manage and understanding what the forces are. And so whether that's in sensor technology that's being developed to understand G-forces, whether it's accelerations, there's a lot of math going into this, and it's way over my pay grade in understanding and how they calculate these things.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, a little teaser we already discussed, but yeah, hopefully our external load that comes out this summer, hopefully is going to benefit you and be a practical solution there.
Oh, absolutely. Looking forward to that.
All right. So finally, I heard you mention before the 8 key domains of high performance. I think it'd be really useful for our listeners to hear what those are in your mind.
Sure. So 5 years ago, we were soul searching what we were doing to improve. And out of this came 8 areas that we felt BMA, our school, needed to improve on or to have in the forefront of our thinking to improve. Those 8 areas, if you think of a wheel, a bike wheel, and the hub being the athlete, the spokes lead out to these 8 areas. And the first one is coaching. The interaction between the coach and the athlete is huge. From a coaching perspective, we think of having lifelong learners who are very good at what they do in their sport, but are also are developing the characteristics that they're becoming highly functioning outside of their sport domain, meaning they're expert generalists. They know a little bit about mental training and they can help athletes work through and problem solve all the way through their equipment. So the coaching is a huge node for us. Collaboration, testing, and research. This was a node that was relating primarily to the U.S. ski team. And that has gone into now, we were the first high performance center from the U.S. ski team outside of the U.S. ski team. And now there are 10 or 11 clubs in the country. So this collaboration has been a huge partnership with U.S. ski team and the other clubs in the U.S. to educate coaches so that we can be better at what we do. Strength conditioning is one of the nodes. Obviously, we talked about that, the importance of all around strength and power development and coordination. Mental training is an aspect of that. And within mental training, there's the mental training associated with the sport, whether that's inspection, imagery work, as well as the mental training of discipline yourself to be consistent in your efforts. And then there's the health and well-being aspect of the mental training side of things. Sports medicine, it's inevitable. Well, not for everyone, but it's highly likely you're going to be injured during your time skiing when you think about the demands of the sport. So our sports medicine, our protocols from when they get injured, what we do all the way through returning them back to sport is a big part of that. Nutrition, recovery, and readiness is a node for us. It's important. We totally revamped our dining hall. Where we're sourcing our foods, how we're preparing our food. So there are no bad options in our dining hall. They're all good options. Then it's on the coaches to educate about how much and when. equipment side of things, we are an equipment intensive sport. Each athlete probably has anywhere from 6 to 10 pair of skis. It has to be the right setup for them, their boots. And so we put quite a bit of time and energy and the resources there for our equipment. And then lastly, our training environment. In the last 3 years, we spent probably $5.5 million on the training environment, whether it's a new indoor training facility, T-bar on the hill, training snowmaking facilities on the hill. And the training environment, it's not just a physical resource. It's not just buildings and structures, although that's a big part of it. Ultimately, the training environment is the people that are in the environment and how they're communicating and working with one another. So those are our 8 nodes of interest for us. And in some areas, we feel like we were pushing forward. In other areas, we were dragging a little behind, but it's the nature of working with people. Sometimes you advance one way and you backtrack another place. But the idea is that we're pushing forward in all of these 8 areas.
Very cool. It sounds like obviously a lot of work went into coming up with that. And I'm assuming there's basically a time each year where you kind of reassess where you are in all 8 areas.
Yes, I have a written on my board here that I look at quite frequently is to move forward, we need to act, learn, and build. So we act and then we look at it. Is it working for us? And we can't be, if it's not working, we have to stop doing it and move some other direction, which we've had to do several times already.
Nice. Very cool. Sounds like you got a great setup there. Actually, yeah, looking forward to finally come see what you guys have, hopefully later this spring, if you let me drop by.
Oh, absolutely. If you come here in the spring, April can be muddy. We look forward to having you here.
All right, great. Looking forward to it. All right, well, that about wraps things up. Thank you so much for your time, Daryl. It's been fascinating to talk with you on some great topics today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And thanks, Ben, for all your support with First Beat.
All right. Thank you. If you like this episode and want to hear more episodes, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to the First Beat Sports Podcast. For more information about us and our sports monitoring systems, give us a call at 435-363-9533. Or you can send us an email to sports@firstbeat.com. You can also visit us online at www.firstbeat.com. Thanks a lot for listening today, and don't forget to be with us on the next edition of the First Beat Sports Podcast.